Hello, hello. Welcome to the Sleon Podcast.
Leon.
My name is Santiago Leon, and today I have Scott Majunkin. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, how's it going, Santiago? Thank you for having me on, man.
Good, man. So Scott Majunkin, a little backstory. I've known him since college, graduate school. We went to Regent University back between 07 and 09. You were there a little bit more than 09, I believe. And he was a business major, and I was a communication major. And we kind of – we weren't, like, best friends then. We became more best friends afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, I think throughout, like, as life kind of took off, you and I developed a deeper friendship. And it's been cool. It's been cool. Yeah. I think it's been about 10 years, man. 10 years.
It'll be 10 years. Yeah, this year, 10 years that we started Regent.
Yep.
And and we graduated during, like, the recession time. So, so Scott, tell me a little bit about yourself since Regent.
Okay, so, well, you kind of prefaced it pretty well. You talked about the recession. So, graduated the winter of 08, 09. It was like that. And so we all know the recession hit late 08. And I was working for an architect, great guy. But, you know, it's here in Hampton Roads. And, you know, contracts dried up, you know, military contracts. And that's a lot of what this economy around here is based off of. And so I didn't know the adventure that was ahead of me at that time. So after Regent, had my shiny new MBA, was doing marketing and business management for this architecture firm, and did some really cool stuff. But 08 happened, and so I started consulting some more and more. I went into the marketplace with the intention of becoming like a turnaround management consultant. I wanted to help businesses that were hurting improve themselves, like turn the business around and become profitable. And that's where I wanted to take my career. So started networking, got in with you know, made some really good relationships and here in Hampton Roads. And I moved to Austin, Texas, there for a time. I think that was like 2011 or 12. And spent about 2 years there, did marketing for a technology company, did some consulting for branding, marketing, continued down that path. Eventually, I made my way back here, did branding. I was running a marketing branding company for this larger company. Anyway, so that's kind of like the career side of it. The emotional, personal side of it is that it was really hard, man. It was really hard. A lot of people in the statistics show people, millennials such as ourselves who graduated at that time, faced a really, really tough economy. And a lot of the assumptions that we had going into the market, into the workforce, turned out to not be true for people such as you and I. You know, the lack of experience, all the companies were contracting during that time. And suddenly there wasn't that much demand for a MBA, you know, people without, you know, years and years and years of experience. And so what I learned during that time was this concept of validation. But I can go into that a little bit later in this podcast, but it really, seeking validation from other people and seeking validation from institutions turned out to probably be my biggest mistake going into the workforce. But in turn, it has fueled what I'm doing right now. And I think, what I'm doing right now is just flourishing, it's blossoming, and the message is getting out there. And but that's kind of what's happened since Regent until today. A lot of trials, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of entrepreneurial thought, and a lot of life lessons learned.
I was going to mention Shopify because Shopify is a really strong force, and they're kind of newer, but their CMS is interesting. And it's interesting about Shopify, most of their plugins are paid. I mean, they're hard to find free ones.
If you're after a certain store or after a certain ease of use and quality, then you will have to invest some money in it regardless of what platform that you're using. So, I mean, WordPress has gotten popular because of free plugins. There's a lot of people, but there are a number of plugins now that kind of have a free version and a pro version. We're seeing the WordPress space, the economics of these developers and so forth, evolving over the years. So, you know, it was hard to make money just offering a free plugin, for example. And then now there's people that, you know, there's paid plugins now, and then there's server-based solutions now that are appearing in WordPress now, where you pay a subscription or something and you get the services of a product, whether it's just making online backups or monitoring your e-commerce store for analytics, that sort of thing. There's still enough plugins, low cost plugins, and even free plugins out there that if you wanted to do some e-commerce with WordPress, it's very cost effective. I think if you're selling things online, then it's worth probably some sort of investment for your money if you are going to be doing it yourself.
Now, for WordCamp, if you're a beginner or don't know anything about WordPress, should he or she go to WordCamp and find out more about WordPress?
Should go to go to WordCamp.org, find the local, your local, like what's the closest WordCamp to you. In the U.S., they're pretty easy enough to get to. For WordCamp Miami, we have people coming down from Orlando, from the entire state, and then people outside of that as well that are just coming down, and they're not even speaking. They're coming down to hang out, basically. And that's the other cool thing about WordCamps as well. About WordCamp Miami specifically, I've been to other WordCamps, and then people says, one guy gave a talk in WordCamp Orlando, and he was saying, oh, I got my first, you know, how I got this job where I'm, you know, I got it by going down to WordCamp Miami. That was pretty cool. We have speakers that go on to speak at huge conferences that got their start by going to WordCamp or speaking at WordCamp Miami too. So it's kind of almost forgot the original question.
Oh, yeah. For beginners or for people that don't know anything about WordPress but are interested, do you think WordCamp, this would be a good event to go to just to learn more about it?
Yeah, like I said, it's really, if you value, if you appreciate value, then yeah, it's worth, even if you have to travel, it's still probably worth the investment in time and money for something like this, especially if you are new to WordPress and you need to get in depth pretty quickly. And conferences, you can't retain everything if you go, especially for a 3-day conference or a 2-day conference. You can't expect to go in and absorb everything and retain it, but it's a great learning environment. So, you know, I tried sitting down at my computer and learning certain things, and I'm mildly successful. But if I go to a conference, I seem to be more focused on things. There's also all these other people around you that want to learn similar things to what you're learning. So it's a great network experience too. And you can collaborate and learn together and talk to people that know more things about certain things than you are and you want to learn. And you walk away from WordCamps not only with some knowledge, but really an energized spirit in terms of, yeah, I'm pumped up now. I want to be able to work on my project or build this client site or something. So definitely, if, like I said, WordPress and all these other things that WordCamps, especially Miami, offers, you want to learn this stuff, then yeah, it's, like, the ticket price is very low. And
Yeah, when I lived back in DC back in 08 and 09, it was very expensive and it was challenging, but you guys provided awesome services. Why is the work of NCC so important to our community?
It's important because in a lot of respects, the work that we do is part of a civil rights movement, and many people in the community are not aware of that, but there's actual legislation called the Olmstead Act that requires persons in the disabilities community to be fully integrated into the community. And it's not a good thing to do, it's not a nice thing to do. It's a right. It's a right and it's a privilege, and they deserve to be able to enjoy the community just as we all do. So NCC provides an opportunity to do job training. We also do travel training. We have programs that take our individuals into the community and give them an opportunity to explore. If they want to do Zumba, they should be able to do Zumba in a class that's Zumba, not a class for persons with disabilities. So our mission is to help them to build their best life, to provide the quality services that they require, and to make the community aware and help them to embrace not disabilities, but people with various abilities.
This year marks the 60th anniversary of NCC. What's in store for your employees and the people you serve this year?
We are so very excited to be celebrating our 60th anniversary. And this year, in my mind, is about celebration of many, many years of accomplishments and success. It is also about community awareness. As I shared earlier, we want everyone to understand that diversity and inclusion is not just about sexual preference and racial and ethnicity and cultural differences. It also is inclusive of the members of the community that we serve. So we're going to celebrate, we're going to make aware, and we also are doing a massive major appeal for new donors to help us in this mission financially. As you look at the news, you hear all the stories about Medicaid caps and potential changes in that world. The persons that we support are very dependent upon Medicaid funding and many of the federal funds that are available. So we're going to be looking and reaching out to corporate sponsors and donors and private donors to help us to continue this great work to make sure that everyone receives everything that they need to live their best life.
And what events do you have planned for this year?
Well, we're still working through that, but there's talk of a 5K. We're planning a huge benefit gala in October that will be designed to re-engage, recommit, and to commit former donors and current donors, and again, to celebrate, to fellowship, to bring awareness, and to ask for support.
Where do you see NCC in the next 60 years?
In the next 60 years, I want us to be cutting edge. When I think about early learning and early intervention, I want us to be the premier site in the city, in the nation's capital. Today, we are fully accredited as an agency, as a center. We are inclusive, meaning that we support children with and without disabilities so that children can learn together and grow together and teach each other. We want to be the model that others from around the world will come and aspire to be. In the world of adults, I look forward to visions of smart homes and leveraging technology that enable persons with disabilities to be even more independent than they are today.
Of all my clients, my mom really was really like, wow, this is awesome organization. You know, it's one of the organizations that she spotted. Oh, NCC, that's amazing. That's what they do in the community and everything. How can someone learn more about NCC and your cause?
Well, the best place to go is our website, nccinc.org. And you can reach out to any of the leadership members that are posted on the board, on the website, and they'll be happy to share more information. Also, opportunities to engage people in the community that want to volunteer, and certainly people that want to help support this great goal and great mission financially.
So, Sean, if a student today wants to intern at Fox or wants to be in Fox, what is a good path for them to get there?
I always say start locally. If you have a local news station, go there. I think a lot of people think I want to go to college and just land right at Fox. I mean, it kind of sounds like what I did, but I'd also been doing it for a while beforehand at a local level. And I think there's a lot of places where just in this day and age of things being streamlined, people doing multiple jobs, if you go to a local outlet, you can learn so much there. So don't negate the fact that if you start lower, it's going to be worse. You're probably going to learn more there, because at some local stations, you're going to shoot, you're going to edit, you're going to do all those things as a one-man band. So when you get to the network and you realize, oh, I have editors, I have all these other resources, it will be easier for you. Or you go into some local radio station, you can have more opportunities, because in some ways they're going to look at you and say, I want this one person to do the job of five people. And that's kind of the reality of the media landscape. There's stations that don't have the most money or the most resources, so they're going to try and get the most out of one person, which means if you're the younger person, you're going to crazy hours, but if you're willing to put up with that, it can pay off, because I've been there, I've worked crazy hours and worked all kinds of shifts, and it's just having a good attitude more than anything. It's a business of divas and a business of people with personalities. If you show you're willing to learn, you show you have a good attitude and you can work with people, that will probably be the biggest thing that will take you far, aside from just having a raw talent. If you have a drive and you're willing to learn, you're willing to work with people, you're willing to be humble sometimes and just do whatever job they give you, whether it's stacking the coffee in the place or making the coffee runs, it's getting in the door. But that, if you want to make that leap to the national level, take the knowledge of what you had, and then you still got to work your way up there. And there's several different ways. Usually the way into the networks is they have an assignment desk, and that can be grueling, but get in there and then work your way up. But also just keep an eye on any opportunity and get to know people and know that it's a small industry. So if you're a jerk to someone 5 or 10 years ago somewhere, whether it's a local station or somewhere else, they could be the person that makes or break you. So even when you don't like people, do your best to get along, because you don't know when you're going to see them again.
Yeah, and like you were saying as well, you know, like you have to know like skills. You have to know how to video edit now. You know how to write, how to shoot, and things like that. Now it's a little bit easier now than it was before, but I really do agree that you have to be multi-level skill, and also work locally. I mean, there's plenty of local stations out there in your town or in another city. I mean, I've seen people that started off in Montana, or they started off in Idaho in these small stations. Sean Hannity started in Alabama.
He did. That's the thing is, everyone kind of has their eye now. I want to get to Fox. I want to get to ABC. I want to get to wherever. But if you're willing, take a year or two of your life, go work for some local station, even if it's in Montana, it's not in the place you want to live. Spend some time there and realize that you might cover the most interesting stories of your career in local news. Because keep in mind, the stories that we like to use for those little funny stories, usually are the stories we comb through, Florida Man or some weird story in Montana. Those are the stories that we love to feature some days, because it's the local news that gets some of these hilarious stories. And now that you have the internet, it gets shared all the time.
Do you recommend ghostwriting? You know, I mean, you know, I mean, of course, you know, people have their schedules, different schedules, but obviously, you could tell the difference between ghostwriting and people that write their own book, you know.
Yeah, so it depends, right? Like so first I just want to say to all the ghostwriters out there, I have much respect for you. I do not know how you do what you do. I could never do that. Like, it doesn't matter how much somebody would pay me. Like, I don't think I could ghostwrite a book effectively for somebody else and like actually get their voice. So that's first thing. Second thing is like, it depends. And what I mean by that is, if a person is like a CEO of a business and they are like completely booked like all the time, right? Because they're running the business, but they know that to grow it and to build their brand, they want to become an author and they just don't have the time. Like, they truthfully do not have the time to write a book. Hiring a ghostwriter is not a bad idea. And if you hire a really good one, like, a ghostwriter can actually really capture somebody else's voice. And it can seem as if though that person wrote the book, you know, like, I've seen it like that. Like, you know, obviously probably like your best friends and stuff can tell, but the general public can't really tell because they don't know you that well, you know? So I would just say it's a lot more expensive. You know, typically you're going to be looking at, for ghostwriting, like a business book, like $20,000, like minimum for a ghostwriting. Whereas if you write it yourself and get it edited, you know, you could be looking more in that $5,000-$10,000 range. For like a full developmental edit. And there's different types of editing. We can get more into that if you'd like, but there's just different types and they cost different. But so to answer your question, I would say it's good for some people, but you know, if you're working on a budget, I wouldn't even like consider it because it's just very expensive, because you know, it takes a lot of time to write a book and it takes even more talent to like write someone else's book. You know, like, that's just, I don't know how people do it, man. I don't.
What is your favorite part of your job?
Favorite part is this. So the podcast is new. My favorite part of Authors Unite is that I remember when I first held a paperback copy of my first book when it came in the mail, and it was a ridiculously like good feeling, like kind of like giddy, you know, like I was like, dude, this is real. Cause like, you're working on this thing, you know, for at least months, like sometimes years, people work on their books. For my first book, it took me like 4 to 6 months or so, to like get it all together and like launch it. And, but either way, like it's like a labor of love, you know? And like, as you're working on it, there's so many limiting beliefs that come up. It's a very bumpy ride. And then when you get that first copy in the mail and you look at it and you flip through the pages, you're like, oh my God, I did it. Like, this thing that was in my mind 6 months later for me is now in my hand. So the fact that I'm able to give that feeling to other people, or like help them give it to themselves, however it is, whether I do it for them or I coach them through it, is a really good feeling to me, because I know what it feels like. So that's my favorite part, is being able to assist in letting others feel that.
If someone's listening or watching this, and they wanted to write a book, I mean, what are the things that you require before they reach you to get this process going?
Yeah, so there is like an application form like on our website that we have them run through. And the reason is just because like, I want to make sure that I can actually help them. So that's like our first screening, if you will. And then after that, I will personally hop on like a 10-15 minute call with them to just make sure it is a good fit. And if it is, then we'll move forward. And what those like criteria are is like realistic expectations. So if somebody comes to us and they're like, I have an idea for this book, I want to sell 1 million copies in a year. Well, first I'll be like, you know, what's your budget? Because to sell 1 million copies of a book within a year, and it depends, right? If this person has like a brand like Gary Vaynerchuk or something, then sure, like you can do it. But like, if you're just starting out, you don't really have an online presence, the chances of that are very, very low of that happening. So want to make sure that the expectations are realistic with the person, so that at the end of the relationship, both of us can look at each other and be like, hey, you know, thank you for your service. The money I invested in you was worth it. And I can say, hey, it was really great working with you. We, you know, effectively executed the plan. So expectations, budget, and also just like what the idea or what the book is, and then my team can research the target market. And if we do believe that the goal can be hit, then we will, you know, engage, you know, for a contract and see if we can move forward with working with them. So we just like to make sure, you know, because some people will try to get every sale, but I think that leads to a lot of not so good things. So like I just, before I even offer to let you purchase, I want to make sure that it is a good fit for both of us, you know?
What have you learned, you know, after doing this business for a couple of years that you didn't know before?
You know, probably I've been a mentor. That's what drove me as a CEO. I love that. I was so passionate about mentoring others to the next level. In fact, I've said for the last 5 years that my role as CEO is not to run hospitals. It's to develop people to be the best version of themselves. But what I've come to realize is that there's a huge difference between coaching and mentoring. So as a mentor, you're the expert. I'm the one with the 25 years of healthcare experience, and I've been there and I've done that. Let me help you along. As a coach, that's not your role. Your role is to be the mirror for your client and to help them uncover what their thoughts and issues are and reflect on that so that they can look inside themselves. You're not providing that to them. You're just helping them to uncover what's already inside them. So that's a big difference. And then on the flip side of that, you know, I've said that my role is to be a coach, to be a trainer, to be a speaker. Coaching or teaching and speaking are somewhat similar. You are the expert. You're in front of the room. You have all the answers. You're the one doing the majority of the talking. In the coaching world, it's the other way around. You're not to be the expert. You can use your expertise, but it's your client who does the majority of the talking. Your role is to ask the right questions to make them think about and reflect upon themselves.
Man, that's amazing. That, I mean, you say you were a speaker. How often do you speak? Because I think you, I mean, you must be great live.
I'm also a lead singer of a few bands in my life, and there's nothing more fun than being on stage and being able to look at the crowd and take them where you want to go vocally, you know, and feel the energy. And so being a speaker gives you some of that same thing. You know, if you're speaking like myself, some people might be able to speak on anything, but I can't. If I'm passionate about something, you know, I can't help it, just comes out. So I'd like to think that, you know, I'm certainly growing. I spoke to a group last week, as a matter of fact, last Tuesday, and one of the people who was in the crowd had been there, had seen me speak a few months prior to that, and she told me, she said, "You are really gaining confidence and your skill set's really developing." So it's like anything else. If you're passionate about it, if you practice, if you work on it, you will get better. Nobody starts out as a great speaker initially. They have to develop those skills. John Maxwell didn't develop those. I mean, he didn't start that way. He had to develop it. So,
yeah, it's definitely, you know, public speaking is pretty, it's one of the scariest things for a human being to do. I mean, I love people, but public speaking, I heard if you could do it 100 of times, you could still get nervous.
Well, and it's the same thing, you know, with being a lead singer of a band. Every time I walked out on stage, that first few minutes or first few seconds, first song or two was terrifying. But once you get past that, then you realize, you know, the crowd wants you to be there. And they're not there. They're not going to throw things at you. At least they never did for me. And they want to hear from you. And once you get past just those general nerves, then you can have a lot of fun with it. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Please finish.
I always, you know, try to think I have something that I have within me that this crowd that I'm going to share with, this audience needs to have. And so if I focus on the audience and what their needs are and how I can be truly a servant leader to them, a lot of fear goes, you know, if I'm worried about what I'm going to say and running off a script, which I don't do. Yeah, I generally will write things out, what I want to say, and then I put that aside. I've got my thoughts in order, and then it's just, you know, I want to interact with the crowd. I want to see what they're doing and look at their expressions and go where they are and meet their needs.
Who is your favorite speaker?
John Maxwell's got to be up there. You know, one of my all-time favorites, who he's passed away now, was Jim Rohn. And he drove me crazy when I first heard him, but then I absolutely loved the man. Jim Rohn, it was one. Zig Ziglar was one. And right now, probably John Maxwell is certainly up there with the best of them.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard Maxwell speak live, I think, at least 5 times, and I mean, he blows me away. I mean, I believe he's the most that is has come out with content pertaining to leadership, I think, and he's just smooth. He's just smooth sailing when he talks.
He is.
And he, like, I mean, for me as a person, I'm a very ADD person, so, but, like, when he speaks, I pay attention, you know?
he has spoken so many times that it comes natural to him. But I promise you, well, maybe not. Maybe at this point in time, he's not, he didn't get jitters. But he feels the audience, you know, and he drives energy from the audience. So
yeah, and you know, like the other type of speaker that I think that really feels the audience are comedians. I think they have to figure out what joke they really have to kick in to make the audience, you know, just to break the ice.
Yeah, well, you know, and John is a great storyteller, and that's what comedians do. They relate to the audience. They can tell stories, funny stories, that. It's funny because you can see it in yourself or you've seen someone else like that. And that's what does it. It's making that connection with your audience.
The first time I heard you speak, Dom, was at another podcast with Tyler, the Business Blast podcast, which I interviewed Tyler a couple months ago. And when I heard you speak,
nice. It
was crisp. It was so motivating me. I mean, I was going through a regular day, you know, nothing too crazy, nothing too down. And when I heard you, you really motivated me. How did you get that motivation? Was your dad a good motivating speaker? Did you learn this stuff in like while with like the army or with like the police department? How did you get this whole speaking thing going?
You know, my dad's a pastor. So is he a speaker? Yes. Is he a motivational speaker? No. Both my parents are prior military and they served a long time ago. You know, I hit rock bottom. And when you, unfortunately, when you struggle with PTSD, you don't realize that's what it is. You don't reach out to people. When I got home, when I moved back to Arizona from Jackson, Mississippi, I would sleep in my closet, like on the floor, because that's where I was comfortable. It was dark. I always kept a gun on me at all times, but that was a space that I couldn't control. I didn't sleep in my bed often. And because you don't share, you're not vulnerable, you're not authentic, you just go to work with this fake smile, you do things on your own. I didn't want anybody telling me what to do. I didn't want to see a shrink. But hindsight, when you see a man breathe his last breath as you're standing over him, it makes you realize how important life is and what people want out of life. Like this young man was asking me to text his mom, like, dude, I don't have your mom's phone number. And after he said that, he's probably died within 10, 15 seconds. But it wasn't, he didn't ask for things. He just wanted his mom. He was 24. So we're the same age at the time, but you find a way to pull yourself up by your bootstraps once life kicks you in the teeth. And one thing leads to another, and you start, I'm a reader. I read a lot of books, and I couldn't take the pain anymore, the emotional pain, and just had horrible relationships. And it was all me. Like, I was at fault for most of this stuff. And the only way I knew to get out of it was to just dig deep. And I learned a lot of these techniques and tactics in the military and the police department, but I think it's just an overall life experience. And I felt that I had a gift and that I could deliver a message to the world, but in the process, I had to fix Dom Fawcett. And I'm not 100% there, but I'm closer today than I was yesterday. So that's My motivation is basically my mission in life is to positively impact one person's life every day for the rest of my life.
Can you tell us a little bit about your slogan, Think, React, and Lead? I like it, but how did you get that going? How did you figure that one out?
So I have a company called Leaders for Leaders, and that's the company I use when I do corporate facilitation. And the mantra for Leaders for Leaders is think as an executive, react like a soldier, and lead. And that's a culmination of my life. I've been a soldier on a couple different platforms. I've been an executive
And to me, think, react, lead, I feel that, and this is how I break it down, this is what I do in my daily life, is I spend about 5% of the time thinking. Reacting is about 80% of the time, and the rest is leading. And I think most of society gets it wrong. They spend a large portion of their time thinking. And that's why so many people don't get any results, because they analyze everything. And when I say react, it's literally decision making. I mean, we can talk about business all day long, but let's simplify it. McDonald's hasn't changed its menu outside of the occasional McRib in quite some time. Yet when we go there, you stand in front of this superfluous amount of offerings and you eat the same thing every single time you go, but you look and you can't make a decision. Like it's those little practices, make a decision. Most people that I talk to aren't responsible for how the world turns. Like we're not responsible for the political front. Like our decisions really don't impact a lot of people, but we lack the ability to just react and make a freaking decision. So the lead part is kind of where the follow through is you make the decision. Now you do everything that's needed to do to make that decision a positive and successful one. Like I left the corporate space, that's reacting. Now the leading part is all the administrative tasks that come along with being self-employed and all those other things, all the non-fun things. But that's how I came up with Think, React, Lead.
You were saying your previous business, you're just in the point of selling it, right?
Yeah, so it's actually already – the equity's already sold. My business partner bought me out. The only thing that was in my agreement was that I would help the transition up until the end of the fiscal year. And honestly, for myself, I wanted to make sure for financial reasons, I want to make sure the year finishes off the right way. So, because I'm generating profit from the business this year. And then after that, then that's when the buyout will officially go live, if that makes any sense. But the transition actually has been amazing. The guy who bought me out actually was my first intern I had 5 years ago. And I developed him over the last 5 years, and he's become one of my best friends. And it just came to both of us. It hit me, like I was saying, as a high-performing man. I was slightly unhappy, not necessarily with the business, but I was slightly not as passionate. And it's because I wasn't being myself. I wasn't being congruent with who I'm supposed to be. And he felt that, I felt it, and we were able to make a win-win deal together that benefits him and myself for the next few years. And we're both freaking pumped about it.
So, having four businesses in your life, I mean, you're so young. Can you name a person or a company that really influenced you to get this far?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, I'll tell you right now that I don't care what anybody says. There's no such thing as self-made. No such thing. Like, you can say you're self-made. And when I was younger, I used to say that. And honestly, I'll tell you right now, first person in my life was my dad. And, you know, he's probably the hardest worker you'd ever meet. And, you know, I looked up to him for most of my life, even to now. And then as you go along your career path, you want to basically build a group of men. Well, a group of people, doesn't have to be men, but a group of people that that give you different things, different value points. Now, again, you have to give them value too. That could be for another topic. But basically along the way, I kind of gathered up this group of guys and women that I look up to that have helped me continue moving forward. And, you know, first was my dad. I have an older brother that I look up to. They were both extremely encouraging for me. Then when I went into college, I met the guy that helped me start my first business. His name's Taylor. He was just an all-around great guy. I looked up to him. And then it was funny. I just got off a call with a man named Maurice. And Maurice and I only knew each other for 3 months when I was younger, like 22 or 23. And 7 years later, we reconnected. And this morning we had a 20-minute call, unsolicited. He called, he said, Matt, pop me a call. He gave me all these unbelievable good tips. He's like 60, 65 and been a owner, president, run way more companies you can imagine. And, you know, and what I found is people want to help other people. And it's just, you know, I think I might've mentioned this in that podcast, which is, it's my favorite quote. It's, you know, yell your goals from the rooftops And the village idiots will come out and try to stop you. And that happens a lot. And sometimes the village idiots are your brain. It's yourself. And it's the doubts, the fears, and anxieties. And then also, obviously, there's probably people in your life that are idiots. But but then what you find is the village leaders come out and they will support you. And again, Maurice out of nowhere, you know, we reconnected on LinkedIn, and it's been 7 years since we spoke. And I was young at the time, super young, and just a great guy. And it just continuously happens, especially when you put into the world and you give value. People want to give you value. And if you become more of a giver than a taker, it just sounds nuts. There's just things that come to you that you can't actually explain to anyone. You're like, wait, how does that continuously happen? Now, again, anytime that I became a taker, which I'm not perfect, and there was definitely a few years in there where I was a taker, I was blaming everyone for my failures. And I'll tell you right now, as soon as you fall into that world, what you're going to find is you're going to get more of that over time. So you're going to get more people that you think, and instead you got to take personal accountability for what's going on in your life. And it's pretty cool what happens when you do that. And then you start looking at it from a different perspective of giving. Like, for instance, if I get, you know, nothing from this podcast, but I get to meet Santiago, and who knows in 10 years what he's going to be up to, who knows what I'm going to be up to. We might, you know, you just never know how the world works, and it's so cool. But yeah, so that would be my,
yeah, answer. No, it's a good answer. Yeah. And you just never know what's going to happen, who you meet, you know, through the internet, through a podcast, you know, and with the power of cell phones and, you know, communicating, which I actually met a guy, about a couple of weeks ago. And that's all he does. He just talks to people. He mentors people over the phone. And he's like, I'd rather just talk you to on the phone than just meet up in person, you know, because it's quicker. It's just, you know, it's just everything's so time, all time managed.
What is your favorite donut that you've created yourself?
Well, you know, when you say favorite, I think of two different things. One, what do I enjoy eating the most? Because that's a totally different thing as like what I've been the most proud of.
Right.
What I've been the most proud of is, oh my God, there's so many that I've loved. I love doing things with seasonal fruit, especially in South Florida, my hometown. We get, you know, all these Caribbean fruits, like, you know, papaya, mango, pineapple, star fruit, all these crazy things that you can't find, that people, guava, that people have never even heard of in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
Something as simple as guava, some people don't know what the heck it is. Even in America, you go into middle America, no, they've never even tried it.
No, not at all.
Never even tasted it. Whoa, it's guava. I love most of the donuts that I've done with tropical fruit. But my all-time favorite to eat that I will always order and enjoy the most is a Boston cream pie. What's a Boston cream pie? It's filled with a homemade vanilla custard. I don't like that pudding canned stuff that most, you know, let's not name any names of donut shops that are out there that use it.
It's cheaper, right?
It's cheaper and easier to make, but it's worth it for the quality that you're going to get. Oh, my God. A homemade pastry cream, custard, it just does not compare to anything you can buy. You cannot buy something that tastes like a homemade custard. That's like saying, you know, you can a store-bought or pre-bought bagged ice cream will taste the same as a homemade ice cream. Oh, no, it does not match up. I make very good ice cream.
There's probably tons of things you make besides a donut.
So those would say my two choices. So I can't really pick a favorite because there's so many. Tres Leches was one of the top ones that I was proud of doing. And I took that same concept. It's really cool because I took off the very top lining of the seal that happens when you fry the donut. And then you expose the flesh that actually absorbs whatever it is that you soak it with. You know, it's the same thing that happens with cakes. You got to peel off that top layer so you can soak the inner, the innards. And I would soak it with the three milks. I spiked it with a little bit of rum and vanilla. And after a half an hour or so, the whole thing turns into like basically the tres leches cake, kind of a pudding. And so it wouldn't get soggy, I dipped the bottom into white chocolate. So, you know, the bottom would stay firm and you could still pick it up and it wouldn't be soggy. And then on top, I just did the traditional meringue and I torched it. And it was a huge hit, especially obviously with all the lovers of, you know, the Cuban community. It's one of their like nostalgic
you know, desserts that they grew up eating, and it became quickly the number one and got put on the menu.
And can you survive in the woods for 1 month?
Yes.
And finally, what would you tell your 15-year-old self?
Get into more school. You know, no mess up. Don't do the wrong thing you did. You know, the main thing I told people, go to school. You need school in life. School is going to take you anywhere you want. The day you drop out, the day you become a loser. Yeah, I told everybody who gave my share, the more you read books, the smarter you are. The day you start reading, that's the day you become dumb.
I am 100% in agreement with you. I see a lot of kids out there that don't go to school. They, you know, leave it aside. And they're like 21, 20. I was like, bro, you got to do it now while you're young.
You know what's so funny? Kids will learn a game, but they won't learn a book.
Oh, and that's happening today a lot. Yes, yes. Kids are playing, like, are playing 4-8 hours of video games all day.
Fortnite, that's the number one game in the world. And you know what's so funny? I told kids what Fortnite would do help you in life. And they say to survive. How you gonna survive?
Yeah,
we're not in the perch and nothing like that.
I was a video gamer until I was 12, and then I stopped, and then I
never got into video games.
Really?
I always played sports all my life.
See, that's
I played football, baseball. For me, it's better to be in the street, have fun with your friends, and be online talking to your friends.
I wish a lot of kids would just, you know, listen to that and they would consider it. I mean, like when I was a kid, I would play kickball outside.
You know what's the matter right now with young kids? They got so many stuff. They want to go outside and play because they can do everything in the house.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with kids right now. And even with phones, you got kids who can type because it's easy to type, but you tell them to write a book, they can't write a book.
Yeah.
That's the problem with a lot with kids. It's not the kids' fault, it's the parents' fault.
Parents' responsibility, they got to teach kids, they got to make sure that they, you know, make sure the kids do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And you're a parent yourself.
Yes.
And I know that you treat them well, and then you definitely, you know, tell them to hustle. You're a hustler. I could definitely tell you that. And how can people reach you, Juno?
They can hit me on Instagram. It's Barber Juno. And YouTube is Juno the Cut.
Juno the Cut. By the way, how'd you get that name? Juno.
Juno.
Because you spell it Junon.
Yeah, Junon. J-U-N-O-N.
Yeah.
I got that name, I don't know, growing up.
Okay,
got me that name.
It happens.
You know what I mean?
We don't know who the originator is.
No. I Google it too. And I don't know. I ain't know nobody with that name.
Yeah. I like it because it's kind of original.
Yes.
In a way, like, you know, Juno. There was a movie about like a fish, or it was like
it was about a girl getting pregnant.
Oh, that's right. Which is a good movie, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's different. But Juno,
they pay me for using my name. They pay me.
That's what I thought.
So. Yeah. But you know what? It's funny because you go Instagram and you look at the barber's name. The Tom Barber's got a weird name. I'll be like, you know what I mean? When I become a barber, I was thinking what kind of name. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to use Juno. I don't see no Juno barber out there.
Also, another thing, on your Instagram handle, I will recommend using barber in the handle somewhere. Okay. You know, Barber Mike or Barber Chris.
Yeah. I tell people, have your own logo with your name on it. A lot of people got logos where Clippers. No, have your name. You want people to know you by your name, not by your logo.
I agree.
Only way is by your logo if you got a company.
All right.
And you got a company, have a logo. But you promoting yourself, use your name.
And by the way, I will not serve justice if I don't ask you about this. Easy Blade, how'd you get involved with them?
Easy Blade, I got...
What are they?
It's a company from New York. It's Janka. It's owned by Jay the Barber.
Uh-huh.
And I met him a couple of shows. I emailed him. He gave me some free products. I told him I will promote him.
You liked it?
I like it. And one day, I met him another show. And he said, would you like to work for my company? And the first thing is, how much you going to pay me?
That's always
good. But at the end, is how much you going to give me?
That's a $1 million question.
Yeah. Right? He gave me a contract. He said, I'm going to give you this contract for now. You let me know you like it. I said, I'll think about it. I went talk to a lawyer to see the deal was official. He said yes. And
looks legit.
I took at least 4 months to answer him.
Okay, that's plenty of time, right?
Plenty of time to think about it. And I agree But after 6 months, I want more money. Because you have to remember, I get paid for shows. He had to give me a hotel, and he had to give me a rental car.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to give me money for food.
Hey, essentials.
Hey, and you want my time costs money. I don't know about the rest of the bar, but my time costs money.
Time is an asset for a lot of people, including barbers.
Yes.
Should barbers these days get involved with sponsorships or get involved with a product? What do you think about that?
What happened? It's hard to get in a company because you got so many good barbers out there.
Yeah.
But in the end, it is if you got a license.
Yeah, that's key.
Because they don't want to sponsor you if you don't got a license.
Yeah, that doesn't look good in the resume. It doesn't look good for the company.
Yeah.
It hurts them. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of them. There was one gel we were talking about the other day. I forgot the name of it. They're from Miami. I'd like to say Frank isn't that name, but it doesn't matter because they're not sponsoring this podcast.
Yeah.
but, yeah, definitely, one of the things I've seen about it is, barber ambassadors, they represent a product and things like that. I've seen that more. I think it's smart business. If you're a good barber, get with it. Get with them. You can make more money. Sky is the limit.
The sky is the limit. And good about being sponsored, you can go around the world and go for free and still get paid and have fun.
Who would have thought about that? Your neighborhood barber could be famous and things like that. So, Janone, thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you.
Any closing words?
Just read books and keep going to school. That's the best thing I can tell people.
Janone, thanks for coming on to this Leon Productions podcast.
Thank you.